This is the Future of HR Podcast, episode 177.
It's that ability we have to comfortably and effectively work in situations that are new and novel and diverse and ambiguous. So it's actually more like contextual agility. It's just all about being in situations of novelty and doing it well. It's interesting, for so long, corporate HR would call it experience. We need to send people abroad so that they can gain cultural agility. And then after a while, they sort of added in training. Like, okay, we need to train people so that before they go to their meeting, to their assignment, to their international assignment, whatever it might be, they can be more effective. So, but what we realized, actually, there's three things involved. So the experience is one part of it. Some kind of preparation and training is another part. But the third part, equally important, is the competencies that you need in order to be effective in the environment that you're in. So those would be things like humility, resilience, perspective taking, curiosity. And I would say those are probably more important than anything else I named. Like, you could take people with those critical cultural agility competencies and put them almost anywhere in the world.
How do leaders develop cultural agility? Why is cultural agility an essential skill in the age of AI? Hi, I'm your host, JP Elliott, and this is the Future of HR Podcast, the only podcast whose mission is to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. On each episode, I interview successful HR executives and thought leaders who are reimagining, rethinking, and leading our field into the future. During our candid conversations, you will learn about their career journeys, their lessons learned along the way, and their insights on how to take our field, and most importantly, your career, to the next level. Most HR teams are executing better than ever, and yet many CHROs are wrestling with the same question. Are we truly creating enterprise value or just delivering excellent support? After interviewing more than 150 CHROs and senior HR leaders, one thing is clear: execution excellence is now table stakes. And while execution earns trust, value creation is what differentiates the best HR teams. That insight led me to create my keynote presentation, Future-Proofing HR, Creating Value by Unlocking the Capabilities of Tomorrow. This isn't a motivational talk. It's a practical roadmap for helping HR leaders move beyond execution and step into a new standard of leadership, evolving from business partners to true value creators. I've delivered this keynote for HR teams at companies like AbbVie, Nike, Corning, Kohler, and LabCorp. And if you're planning an HR conference or leadership event and want your team to leave thinking and operating at a higher level, visit futureofhr.com to get in touch. Let's design a keynote that meets the moment HR is in right now and helps your team show up differently because of it. And with that, my guest this week is Paula Calagiri. Paula is a leading expert on cultural agility and global leadership effectiveness. She is a distinguished professor at Northeastern University, co-founder and president of Skillify, a best-selling author, speaker, and host of the International Business Today podcast. Paula spent decades studying what makes people effective living and working internationally and how leaders grow through deep, developmental, cross-cultural experiences. Her work focuses on helping individuals and organizations build the skills needed to operate beyond comfort zones, especially in unfamiliar, complex, and diverse environments. She has authored or co-authored several award-winning articles and books, including Cultural Agility, Building a Pipeline of Successful Global Professionals, Build Your Cultural Agility, and Live for a Living. Paul is also a fellow in both the Society for Industrial Organizational Psychology and the Academy of International Business. And in my conversation with Paula, we're going to dive deep into her latest research on cultural agility and leadership in the age of AI, exploring why these human capabilities are becoming even more critical as technology reshapes the way work gets done. I'd love to hear your thoughts in this episode, so feel free to drop me a note on LinkedIn. And with that, here's my conversation with Paula. Paula, welcome to the Future of HR podcast. How are you?
I'm doing well, JP. Fun to be here.
It's great to have you on the podcast. Great to get to know you more recently. Thank you again for the invitation to be on your podcast, which I will link to in the show notes. That was a true pleasure. Incredible program you have.
Thank you. No, it was a lot of fun too.
Well, you've had an amazing career from teaching, writing, and being an entrepreneur to advising Fortune 500 companies around the globe. And so I'm curious, what first sparked your passion for studying people, culture, and just work around the globe?
It's a story that goes back to my junior year of college. It was 1987. I was studying abroad. But for those of us old enough to remember 1987, in the fall, the market crashed. Basically, I ran out of money. So I was in Rome, Italy, without money. And my parents said, sweetie, you've got a choice. Either find a job or come home. And I didn't want to go home. So I found a job, which made my experience very different from the rest of my classmates. They were wealthy and they could ask for mom and dad for money, and they got money. I didn't. What ended up happening, because I had a very rich cultural experience, I returned back to Buffalo, New York, where I was finishing up my undergrad degree for the second semester of my junior year. And I was mopey. I was sad. I was depressed. And I'm in the psychology department working as a work study student. And a couple psychology professors said, Paula, what's wrong? You seem so different. I said, I don't know. And they were great. They said, look, if this was a profound experience for you, if it changed you in some way, it means it changed others too. You should study that. So they sent me to the library, and I'm studying now, like looking up things about repatriation adjustment. And sure enough, my grad school application to an IO psych program said, I want to study what makes people effective living and working internationally. And I want to know how they change from deep developmental cross-cultural experiences. So it's a long story to the rest of my career. I'm still studying what makes people effective living and working internationally and how they change. It's expanded in a few different ways, but the core is the same.
Yeah, it's so amazing. Like, you just really felt that passion. How many places have you lived outside the US besides, is that Italy?
Italy twice, actually. I was in Milan for 3 years. That was great fun.
Have you traveled also extensively as well as part of your work?
Yeah, that's been the joy of this career. It's taken me everywhere in the world.
Yeah, it's so amazing because I think sometimes we forget that if you are US-based, right, we're only 330 million out of 7 billion plus people. So there's a big wide world out there that we have never experienced, never seen, different foods, different ways to interact. And I think this is amazing. I wish we had more time to get out and do that. Like, I need a second lifetime to travel around. But you've been teaching most of your career. In fact, your entire career, you've really been teaching from that moment on. And one thing I found out about you, which I just loved, is that you've kept all your handwritten notes from your students they've given you, which, by the way, the fact they're giving you handwritten notes says a lot. So that's really cool. And you've actually shared these kind of 5 lessons from that journey on LinkedIn. Can you share those lessons with us?
Sure. So the story behind that was that some months ago, I was cleaning out my closet. I found this bin of handwritten notes, and sentimental, it was raining out. It was one of those days to reflect, and I was reading through them, and they were beautiful. I sat down and wrote that LinkedIn post about all the lessons in 30 years of teaching, all the lessons my students taught me. It was profound. There were 5. One of them was that any one person can change everything. So for better or for worse, one student in the class who's fantastic and they just up the game because they're engaged and they get everybody else more engaged, which is wonderful. But same thing, if somebody wants to bring it down, they can too. So that was a good one. Another one was vulnerability builds trust. So this was a very specific thing that had happened. My partner of nearly 20 years passed away a few years ago, and it was in the fall. I was teaching. I thought I could do it. Like, I thought, oh, I'll just distract myself, go into class and teach. I was with my undergrads at that particular night. I couldn't get through it. I told the students, sorry, I have to take a break. I was crying. It was the only time I think I've ever actively cried in front of a class in 30 years. And the students were so sweet. I kind of regained my composure, tried to muddle through it a little bit, but they basically ripped off a sheet of notebook paper, and each of them wrote a note. And at the end of the class, they handed it to me. I was so touched. From that point forward, that class was so warm and open and collect. You know, there was a sense of belonging. My feeling toward them, their feeling toward me just changed. It was real. It was authentic. That was a learning they taught me. Spontaneity is gold. That one's a quick one, right? You just
dance in the moment, and the more they got me to the place where they needed to go and we could be in that moment together, that was great. Another one was the generational differences or cultural gifts, the vulnerability build trust, but the generational differences. We joke, being a university professor, we are one of the few professions where everyone around you stays the exact same age while you keep aging. I started off, I was teaching at Rutgers. I was the same age as my master's students. And now I'm the age of their parents, if not a bit older. That was a good one. And then with every generation comes, you know, just differences in style. That's been a gift. And then the last one was how much my students notice my behaviors as much as my words. Just became very, very conscious of what they were watching and what they were mirroring and what they were reflecting back to me. So they were all beautiful lessons, and I'm grateful for all of them.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Obviously, an amazing teaching career. But when you think about it, it's about giving back to those students and what they've given back to you as well, which is so interesting because I think sometimes we always think, well, the teachers are giving, but actually a lot we can learn from the people who are around us that are students that are really helping to show up that mirror of how we're doing as well. And so the last one about your behavior and like watching what you're doing versus what you're saying means a lot. And obviously the vulnerability piece was a great story.
Yeah, thanks. That last one in particular, I think now is especially important to be able to say, I don't know. When a student would ask a question legitimately, I didn't know the answer. Just how do you handle that? And that's so important now. It's such a skill that needed to be modeled. So you have to be good at getting, you know, being humble in the moment.
There's a lot of things we don't know. I think maybe the older you get, or I remember getting my PhD, what I learned there was like the more that I got educated and learned about IO psychology, it was like, oh, the more I don't know about things. And there are absolutely a lot of things I do not know. You know a lot about cultural agility. You've written extensively about it. And for those of you who may not know, how do you define it? And just talk about why you think it's such a critical skill today.
Sure. It's that ability we have to comfortably and effectively work in situations that are new and novel and diverse and ambiguous. So it's actually more like contextual agility. It's just all about being in situations of novelty and doing it well.
How do you think about developing contextual agility? Where do you develop that skill to actually have that contextual agility?
It's interesting. For so long, corporate HR would call it experience. We need to send people abroad so that they can gain cultural agility. And then after a while, they sort of added in training. Like, okay, we need to train people so that before they go to their meeting, to their assignment, to their international assignment, whatever it might be, they can be more effective. So, but what we've realized actually, there's three things involved. So the experience is one part of it. Some kind of preparation and training is another part. But the third part, equally important, is the competencies that you need in order to be effective in the environment that you're in. So those would be things like humility, resilience, perspective taking, curiosity. And I would say those are probably more important than anything else I named. Like you could take people with those critical cultural agility competencies and put them almost anywhere in the world. You could put them in almost any context in the world. You could put them in any new and novel situation because they would do what they needed to do in order to learn the environment.
I know we're going to go a little bit deeper on those in a minute. I've got a couple more questions on the skills around that, but perspective shifting, tell us a little more about that. The list you went down, I think there's a lot of things in HR we talk about. Resilience, curiosity, they're a little buzzwordy that we get into HR, but perspective taking, it's something I haven't really heard as much.
Yeah, perspective taking is very simply the ability to see the same situation through another lens. The idea that two people who've been socialized differently, two people who have had different life experiences, two people who come from different parts of even the organization can look at the exact same objective situation and see it differently. Or that two people could interpret something subjective differently, the smile or silence. So perspective taking just recognizes that there's multiple ways to see something.
Yeah. Feels like we need more perspective taking right now in the world. at all levels, just to kind of take a step back and really do that, because it's an important one. I had Rhonda Morris, who's the CHRO of Chevron, on a while back, and now she's now left Chevron, and I think she's a board member of Workday, but she talked about being other focused, and it just stuck with me. And I think it's such an important lesson for HR leaders, but just almost anyone in general, to be other focused. How does that fit in with cultural agility and perspective taking?
Yeah, there's kind of two buckets of these competencies. One is self-management, and another is relationship management, or being other focused. Relationship building, perspective taking, and humility. The ability to kind of be able to say, look, I can be really good in what I do, whether finance, strategy, pick the field, geology, whatever it might be. But I need to build those relationships to learn how to be effective here or in that context. It's all the relationships we're building in order to help us learn the environments that we're in. It's also those relationships we're building because no one person can have all the answers anymore. The world has become far too complex for that to be the case. So important for everyone, especially important for HR.
Yeah, that's a great point. And no one definitely has all the answers. Let's talk a minute about organizations. And many big global organizations are trying to develop global talent. What are some mistakes that organizations are making trying to develop enterprise leaders, global leaders?
Probably the biggest one that I've seen, the biggest mistake, is equating time in another country with cultural agility. What often happens is the belief is that if you get picked up from one country and get transported over to another country and breathe the air of that country for some number of days, weeks, months, years, fairy dust drops over you and you become culturally agile and therefore should be a global leader to lead the company forward on an international level. And that's not the case. It's a lot about what happens while you're in a country, what happens in your ability to question your assumptions, see the limits of your knowledge, understand the importance of context. And the more that kind of is embedded into the experience of being in another place, the more individuals actually build that particular competency. So from an HR lens, the biggest mistake I see is that, you know, you watch those succession plans and someone gets placed in another country, but then they get placed in expat housing and they're only interacting really with compatriots and their environment is almost identical to their headquarter environment. And there's some difference, but that's almost ignored. And because they're at such a senior level, everybody is kind of shaping to them as opposed to them having to adapt anything. And then they come back and move on. That's been a pretty pervasive problem.
That's so interesting. If you had to design a better international assignment, global assignment, how would you think about success criteria? Like, what would you not do? Sounds like don't put them into an expat community, give them a private driver and chef, and basically make sure it feels just like they were when they were home in the US, for instance, right? But how would you shape that around?
It's a strategy question. When we work with companies, it's always like, okay, well, sometimes you just need someone to get something done, something technical that needs to happen in another country. Absolutely. Put them in expat housing, have them, it does not matter because the development dimension isn't really an issue. But if you have a senior leader or somebody who really does need to gain these skills, you might want to just make sure that, of course, make sure they're safe, make sure their families are comfortable, make sure everybody's living a great life while they're there. You don't want anyone to experience hardship. But at the same time, you could ensure that quality of the experience has the developmental components. So we spend a lot of time just doing audits of experiences to make sure that they have developmental components. If not, we make sure that some additional things are added in order for the experience to be truly developmental.
Yeah, that's very helpful. In my experience around this, to your point of, are you open to the new experiences? Are you curious? Are you learning how that local team operates that's different, how you operate, local customers? And you have to do that to be successful overall in some of these roles. But to your point, not every role should go global or has a real benefit to going global. Some of them do. To your previous point too, sometimes we make mistakes of like, let's just get them in the country for a few years versus being really particular about certain roles and the learning objectives, if you will, that it's going to help them. lead the business better when they come back, right? And have a perspective of, oh, this is what Latin America is actually like and what our Latin American customers are like versus I just lived in Latin America for 2 years.
Your point is so important. And just to underscore that, there are some senior executives, high potentials, whatever, expat assignees, who just because of who they are, they're naturally curious and they're naturally humble and they're naturally whatever, they will develop from any experience you give them. That's kind of a natural. What's really concerning is the flip side of that. Some people who are sent just for a technical job, the development was never part of the plan. They just needed the skill set in a place for some duration of time, maybe to transfer skill or something like that. But they were curious and humble and interested. Well, guess what? They're building their cultural agility. And then they get sent back, brought back to originally where they were. And they're like me when I was a junior in college, moping around my college in Buffalo. It's like they don't fit anymore in the situation that they're in because they gain skills that aren't necessarily part of their job. And that's usually when companies will lose people who have gained really precious skills.
Yeah, the research I've read on this is that we're really bad at bringing people back from an expat assignment. And actually, the turnover rate is really high. And I don't know if you have information on this, more fact-based, but it's been a while since I've seen some of this research. But it seems like organizations are great at deciding to send someone to fix a business problem, or there's a hole, or there's a development experience. But when that person wants to come back to corporate, it's not easy to get these jobs open. Things happen. And I think that's where it was something around 50% of expats actually leave the organization and don't come back and get repatriated. Is that accurate or am I off on my stats?
They're a little bit high, that 50% failure rate thing. And in part, there's a lot of things going on. One of them is sometimes if someone is really not doing particularly well, they might say something like, oh, my children aren't adjusting or my spouse can't adjust or whatever. And so it seems like it's a repatriation issue, but it's actually something like a family issue. So there's been a question of like who in the family is sort of leading the desire to repatriate. The other was the issue that was mentioned around they've gained skills that are no longer needed. So they're placed in a new role upon returning that doesn't require these cultural agility, contextual agility that they now have. That tends to be the bigger situation. I think a really interesting statistic for HR to understand is that roughly splitting about 50-50, half of the people who want to do these assignments want to do it because they have that like just fire in their belly and motivation to get out there and explore and see and do, right? And that about the other half tend to be the ones who want to do it for the sake of their career. It's the next step. You need that ticket punch. You need to do it in order to keep moving up. I can't even say that one does better than the other upon repatriation, but you just have to kind of take it into account that if someone's really going because they love this, chances are they're going to want another big global role.
Interesting. We've also been studying tech leaders and their view on soft skills of the future. What stood out to you most from that research?
It's kind of a strange leap, right? From being the culture person to being this person studying the soft skills of tech. But if you think about it, when maybe I first started my career, late 80s, early 90s, the greatest novelty that organizations had their talent engage in was international. And then moved to global teams, cross-functional teams, there was novelty embedded in that. And now novelty is everywhere. We're all experiencing situations of novelty. So when we think about AI, the AI future, the tech future, we did the study because I wonder if it's the same soft skills needed for the future of AI. What I was shocked about was the answer was yes. And that 94% of these tech leaders saw these durable soft skills, resilience, humility, perspective taking, tolerance of ambiguity, curiosity, as critical for the future. These were tech leaders. The future of AI is going to be a bit more human.
We'll say more about that. So it sounds like there's a lot of parallels between cultural agility and being a good leader in the age of AI. But you're also saying, like you just said there, that it works for me more human. Not everyone, I think, has seen that or believes it. So tell us more why you believe work will be more human.
JP, you're talking to a lot of leaders in HR. So everybody's talking about how work is changing in the world of AI. And certainly some work will be automated. Work that will be automated will be automated. There's going to be a lot of work, though, that's integrated. Humans interacting with AI, machine learning, and whatever. The part that's remaining that AI cannot do is going to be especially human. Building trust, fostering belonging, reading the air, reading the context that you're in, understanding a situation, showing empathy, so many things, influencing, persuading, leading. There's so much that's left for humans to be uniquely human, but what's remaining is a bit of a leap into a lot of individual stretch zone. And because of that, that means these other skills have to be present for them to be comfortable with.
How do you think about, because not everyone has cultural agility, not everyone has a great contextual agility, yet these skills will be really important in the future. I mean, how do you think about developing this? Truthfully, do people develop, are they born with this? Are we talking about kind of the 50% of us hardwired with intelligence and kind of capabilities and our predispositions, and maybe 50% or so is our experiences and education, all those things that sort of happen to us and our attitudes. But I think it's a big question. Like, I don't know if we figured this out. Like, how do we really develop some of these skills? Because they're hard.
Yes, one is definitely not a lunch and learn. So actually, I'm going to complicate it even a little more. Not only is it hard to develop, this is some of the most unnatural things we're asking humans to do. So we, by definition, love predictability and comfort. That's how our brains are wired. We like our tribe. We like to know what's coming. You know, so we are still behaviorally wired, if you will, to not want to go into situations of novelty. We're sort of leading with that this is not the most natural thing. But then we go to, okay, so how do we become good at it? And exactly to your point, you know, it's that nurture nature part. Imagine a recipe for each of these skills. There's some parts of the recipe, if you will, that are so fundamentally hardwired, how our bodies handle things like serotonin and dopamine, and that bubbles up to dispositional personality traits. Every one of these soft skills has its own recipe. Then the ingredients mix differently depending on the person. But then what's remaining is behaviors you can learn, things you can learn how to do, things you can practice in order to get better at it. So, like pick any of them, like resilience is a good one. We know that part of resilience would be neuroticism, emotional strength, right? So that's kind of a little more baked, a little more hardwired. But then you can learn coping skills, and you could learn problem-focused coping and symptom-focused coping, emotion-focused coping. You can do all kinds of things to build that skill. It's an example, but yeah, it sort of means that we need to change a little bit how we think about building those skills.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like we have to be a lot more intentional about building some of these soft skills, which the word soft is probably not wrong or the wrong way to describe them. I think they're kind of power skills. Maybe they're the future more human skills that aren't really that natural.
Yeah, I call them durable skills.
Durable skills. That's beautiful. I like that's good too. Yeah. And then if it's not easy to build, then we're going to have to spend even more time doing it, because I do think we typically don't move to things that are hard to do. Building resilience and coping mechanisms, I'd probably rather not have to have coping mechanisms. So I think it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. The other thing I want to ask you about, Paul, is you've built a company called Skillify over the last 3 years, which is incredible. Maybe tell us a little more about what Skillify is, and I won't do it justice, but also what inspired you to start it and how you're helping people build skills that we've been describing today with Skillify.
These durable skills are so critical. So what we decided to do, our angel investor, this guy by the name of Andy Palmer, and he said, Paul, this contextual agility, cultural agility, it's too important to not put it out there more broadly. So what he helped us do is build a tool called MyGuide. It's a pretty exciting tool because it uses an AI coach and it uses gamification to try to help individuals build those durable human-centric skills, things like resilience and perspective taking and humility and curiosity and the like. And it's been interesting because we have clients that are universities and they're using it with their entire freshman class to try to help them build these skills, these durable skills throughout their college experience. but we also have corporate leadership development programs using it. It's the same set of skills that are needed regardless of where you are in your career. And they're durable because once you have them, you have them, not a half-life. So Skillify has been doing a lot of that. It's been a really exciting journey.
And you guys are probably learning a little bit around, I guess, with the data to see how people are leveraging it and what's working. And thinking about that, what is working? What advice would you give to HR business leaders to help build more adaptable, globally minded teams at scale, potentially, right? How do you think about this if you want an organization to just get better at this?
I would love for more organizations to think about this earlier in the pipeline, to think about who they're bringing in, what's on their resume in terms of the things they sought out. Did they play it safe or did they want to test themselves? Do they have more of that growth mindset? Do they have that ability to really seek out pretty significant experiences? So see who you're bringing in to the organization. And then it's like really any textbook HR question, right? It's who are you attracting in? Who are you selecting in? What are you selecting for? I would argue that it would be helpful for organizations that really do need to compete on these situations of novelty that they actually selected for these competencies. I think that's really helpful. Of course, then it turns over to training and development. I think there's some things we can be doing on the training side. A lot of our client companies use MyGuide for that purpose. And then the other piece of it is really development. And what are those bigger experiences individuals are receiving, those opportunities to really start quickly moving the needle on these competencies? And are we crafting those experiences well so they become developmental? It goes all through the pipeline.
Great. Paul, last question for you. What is one word or phrase that you believe will define the future of HR over the next 5 to 10 years?
That would have to be adaptability. Adaptability, because I think so much is going to be changing in our field, just in terms of the nature of work, how work is configured, the types of skills people will need in order to thrive. Yeah, I think it's going to be adaptability.
Thank you so much for being on the podcast and helping us understand cultural agility.
My pleasure, JP. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Future of HR Podcast. Thanks again to Paula for sharing how cultural agility, humility, and perspective taking shape effective leadership in the age of AI. As always, you can go to futureofhr.com to view all of our past episodes and learn more about our mission to inspire the next generation of HR leaders. And if you enjoyed this episode of Future of HR, I think you'll enjoy my Future of HR newsletter, which is the only newsletter that's focused on helping you to elevate your career and business impact. Go to futureofhr.com to subscribe and be sure to download my HR Leaders Blueprint, which is 18 pages of real-world advice from 100-plus thought leaders with simple, actual, and proven strategies to advance your career. We'll be back next week with Pat Waters, who's an experienced CHRO, having led HR at LinkedIn, ServiceNow, UKG, and she currently leads HR for Intuitive, which is a global technology leader in robotic-assisted, minimally invasive care. Pat is also the author of Unlock Your Leadership Story, How to Build Understanding and Motivate Teams Using Fables and Folktales. This is a must-read for HR leaders who want to communicate more effectively and be a more effective leader. In my conversation with Pat, we're going to discuss bringing a product mindset to HR, unlocking your leadership story, and why she believes HR shouldn't always be in the front of the room. You won't want to miss this terrific conversation. Thanks again for being part of the Future of HR community.